Farah Muhammad, thank you for joining us in the studio today. And welcome back to Start Well.
Thank you very much for having me. 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago, yeah. The then prince started the Prince's Trust. It exists, first it was in the UK, and essentially when he started it, he was well ahead of everyone else. He said, look, we need to focus on young people, yep. And we need to focus on sustainability. Nobody was talking about sustainability, and nobody was talking about young people. Here we are, almost 50 years later, what should we be talking about is young people. So, you know, the organization essentially in Canada, we focus entirely on young people. We're all about creating pathways for those young people to employment.
Has the King made any comments about Canada? Or, you know, what's his perspective on having seen, you said 15 years in 2026?
It's a great question. A couple of years ago, he was here, and he had the opportunity to meet with some young people. And I think he walked away with an understanding that there are some amazing things here, talent, you know, wanting to help young people, and that there was a lot of work that needed to be done. So that's the first thing I would say. The other thing is, most people don't know this, but just before his coronation, the King met with the leaders of First Nations, Métis, the AFN, Métis, and ITK. And he met with them to better understand what some of their challenges are. And there's a direct line now to his office with these three organizations, because it's such an important part of who we are.
Founded in 2017, Startwell is Toronto's independent hub for innovators to collaborate. Our podcasts relate perspectives from the world's most diverse urban population to reflect unique insights into global business, media, and culture.
Farah Muhammad, thank you for joining us in the studio today, and welcome back to Startwell. You've been here before?
I have. Thank you very much for having me. We had our team retreat here.
And that was at a crucial juncture where the whole thing was being rebranded, right?
It sure was. Well, you know, we were at an interesting time. We had a brand new team.
Yeah.
Looking at brand new programs, new partnerships. So it was an exciting time for us. And now we're 1 year later.
It's been a year?
It's been a year. Well, no, sorry. It was
Could've
April.
Been.
It was actually, it was April when we were here. So it's been less
Feels
than a
like
year.
10 years.
And
wow.
We're already planning our next retreat here.
Excellent, man. I like hearing that. It was the Prince's Trust, and
it
now
was.
It's become the King's Trust.
That's right.
And tell me a little bit about the organization before we dive into, like, who is Farah Muhammad?
Okay, well, I'd prefer to talk about the organization, but let's do it. So 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago, yeah. The then prince started the Prince's Trust. It exists, first it was in the UK.
Okay.
We're actually the second ones to come to be a trust. And then there's Australia, New Zealand, international, that deals in places like Pakistan and Latin America. And then, although not a Commonwealth country, the U.S.
Okay.
also has a trust there. And essentially, when he started it, he was well ahead of everyone else. He said, look, we need to focus on young people.
Yep.
And we need to focus on sustainability. Nobody was talking about sustainability, and nobody was talking about young people. Here we are, almost 50 years later, and what should we be talking about? Sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
What should we be talking about is young people. So, you know, the organization essentially in Canada, we focus entirely on young people. We're all about creating pathways for those young people to employment.
Okay.
And we're his flagship charity here. So for us, it's really important that we do this in a meaningful way.
Right.
In a way that really propels people forward in a way that they would not have been able to reach their full potential.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do. We do it in partnerships with others. We've got a great team, fantastic board, programs now that I think really are built for purpose.
Okay, what do those look like? Like, how do you guys function?
Yeah, I'll back up a little bit. When I took this role, you know, we remember we're coming out of COVID, right? Mm. The world has changed. Young people have really been thrown for a loop.
Oh, yeah, especially if they were like, well, I guess any age. But certainly, I keep hearing from people that were going into university in 2019. Maybe even had that 1 year experience of social life. And
That's
then
right.
all of a sudden, the antithesis of that. And they had a lot of questioning. They had a lot of unfortunate, isolation, right?
Yeah, I remember thinking your first year. You know, you were figuring it out for the first time by yourself. Nobody was telling you to go to bed. Nobody was telling you to do your homework. Nobody was telling you anything. You had to figure it out for yourself. So already you remove that sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
Then the connectivity.
Yeah.
I made some of my best friends to this day in uni.
Yeah.
Right? So we took away all that stuff. But what we figured out really quickly was, in today's world of work, when you go and ask an employer, why aren't you hiring a young person for an entry-level position? They'll say, well, they don't come with resiliency. They're not creative. They don't know how to communicate. They don't know teamwork. They'll list all those things we used to call them soft skills, which I think is a terrible word for something that actually gives you power.
Yeah.
Then we went to young people and we said, why are you not getting these jobs? And almost to a T, they said, well, I'm being told I don't have this, 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 and this. We went to youth groups and we said, hey, you know, what are you guys finding? And we went to schools and we found out, well, that's not being taught there across the board. So we created a skills academy.
Okay.
It has all of that stuff that employers want to see. It's 40 hours of learning, online, in person, credited by Humber. So they actually get an accreditation for a number of different competencies.
Awesome.
So they've got a skills academy and they can run with that. We're going to go into high schools, but right now we're with community groups that, and organizations like the cadets.
Okay.
Right? So you can go national. Then we said, okay, well, let's, that's the skills gap. What about the experience gap?
Right.
So we created a program called 360. 2-year program, super simple. First month is the skills academy. Next 11 months, they're working in a corporate role.
Yeah.
So it's the like corporation.
Job placement. This is like work study.
Yeah, but
study.
It's a little bit different.
Okay.
So the corporation gives us the JD. Okay.
What's
so
JD?
You say, sorry, the job description.
Okay.
So you give us a job description. You say, here's the role.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
We go out and we find that young person. That person comes to you and they live by your rules. So if we're 2 days in the office, we're three, but say we were, and you're 4 days, they're living by your rules.
Right.
So you're going to pay them a living wage. So what we've done is we've de-risked that young person because they've got all these skills. They come to you, they get a great experience, they get a living wage, and they get a coach from us. So they're not running to your HR department. This is often their first job. Let's help them.
Yeah.
The second year, they get a mentor. If you're a if you want to be in banking, why do you have a doctor as a mentor? We have to do intentional mentorship,
right?
And then they join an alumni.
Yeah.
So that's the experience part. The last gap we found was networking.
Okay.
So between us, hey, do you know X?
Mm-hmm.
Like today, we just had a conversation about who do we know?
Yeah,
right?
Pre-mic, we're just talking about like the music industry. It's like, oh, I sit on this board
music,
and oh, I know that
arts,
guy.
Right. Between us, we can do that.
Sure.
If you ask most young people today, they can't do that.
They don't have the network.
Even worse, they don't know how to network.
Right.
So we've created a program called simply The Network.
I think that's powerful because also the like old school network is kind of not activated anyway. Like everyone tapped out. Everyone in the 40s and 50s, in the 50s tapped out in the last 5 years and kind of, you know, are a little like less quick to act on things.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think it depends,
know?
Right? I mean, in my field of work, I think probably in all fields of work, but in ours, if you're trying to raise money or get partners, whatever, it is about who you know.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Sure.
It truly is. So these three programs taken together are about putting a young person on a journey.
Yeah.
And that's the key, right? These one-offs, you can do them and they're going to have an impact. But if you put a young person on a journey, you can just watch them fly. And these are high potential youth who want to work.
Right.
They've got that ambition. They've got that drive.
Mm-hmm.
But they need a shot.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, it's awesome
very
work.
Cool. Yeah, it's also the sort of work that, like, it's interesting because as society changes, right, especially I'm seeing it as someone who grew up at a young age, like until 11, moved away from in Canada, moved away from Canada, came back. And then now I'm seeing this, like, last few years kind of rapid change in Canada and in our demographics and in also the economic burden on our demographics, right? And how, like, even from tech, the standpoint of, like, the employment base and how that's evolving.
Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, we do have a very different world than the one we grew up in.
For sure.
Right?
For sure.
Now, you have to fight for a job. There's fewer jobs. There's increased competition. But young people do want to work. And if we don't put them to work, what kind of world are we going to live in? They're not going to be skilled. They're not going to have the experience. They're not going to be leaders.
Right.
A bunch of people are going to retire. Who's coming up the pipeline?
Yeah.
So I think we have to be a little more honest with ourselves about inaction around youth unemployment.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there is this like misnomer, right? If people have a bias against employing youth because they're assuming that experience trumps willingness, enthusiasm, energy. In many cases, they get it wrong. They get it wrong. They're buying these dogmatic, tired people at high prices when like they could have so many people that are coming up with creative solutions to problems that everyone ignores within an organization.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the mix, though, right? You need to have
those who have... Because you need mentorship, right?
Right, you do, but you need to have people who are really educated, those who are educated and have more experience, those who have experience, those who are from away, and those who have been brought up here.
Sure.
And it's the magic of that mix that actually gets us the right workforce. So I'm not saying, you know, forget about education or experience, go with the young person who has high potential. Right. No, there's got to be a mix there. Mm-hmm. That's how I grew up. I grew up surrounded by people who are high achievers on one hand. I grew up with other people who were like, hey, you know, I just want to get a day job, right? I don't want to eat, breathe, sleep my job. But somewhere in there, I found myself. If we don't expose young people to both, like the polar opposites, they're not going to find their way.
Yeah.
Right? And you get what you, well, in this case, you get what you pay for.
So let's talk about you then.
Wait, before I do that, I just want to say one thing, which is I love that you're focused on this issue because you're hip. People listen to you. You've got a great audience.
Thank you.
And so I think it's important that we do have these conversations. You know, I for the sake of your listeners who don't know, if we do nothing about youth unemployment, we're going to lose $18 billion toward our GDP. The government's not going to realize $5 billion in revenue. We're going to have lost 228,000 jobs. We cannot afford that. I'm in my 50s. Mm-hmm. I want to retire and have the social services. If we don't fix this, those aren't going to exist.
Oh, yeah.
So for your listeners, I think it's important true. That we understand what's at risk here.
Yeah, and for our audience outside of Canada, I think they have to kind of like understand where our economics are a bit unique as well. We're a small country in a big land mass spread along one line that's just like a côté to the border with the U.S., but at the same time, our relevance to the U.S. on a day-to-day level is pretty next to nil outside of consumption of media culture. And
well, there's a lot of trade between our borders, right? But that doesn't touch the individual.
Daily lives, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one looks at like where things are made on the label and stuff. So,
yeah.
And then, so it's very interesting because this question in Canada of the Canadian identity and what defines Canadianism is coming up more and more, I think, every day. And it's interesting because it's not like people tend to focus on the near past often enough because it's easy to be nostalgic and wish for like, you know, change to be as easy as putting on your Birkenstocks from 1994 again. But like the truth is that the near future is far more exciting because it's something that, you know, you can affect change in. And definitely, I think our youth are the only immediate access to affecting change, you know. And I think a lot of innovators who are part of our the Startwell kind of community, you know, in whatever level of enterprise that you're in, if you're in a startup or a big company, but you wear a hat of being an innovator and collaboration is important to you, so you have to be able to communicate the values of innovation or for innovation
and also connecting dots this. Right, like it's a very different individual who's an innovator.
Yeah.
Right. You said it yourself. The creation that comes out of young people or those who have experienced a different way.
Yeah.
I don't think we would be where we are as society. I mean, we wouldn't have, look at your phone. We wouldn't have half of what we have now.
Right.
It's enabling us to live differently.
Right.
So it's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And like that catch up story on Canada for people who aren't from here in the audience is that we're in this crisis in Canada where the population across the board, outside of net new immigration and the waves of whether that's we're having a big year or slow year for that, you know, we're trending into a massively aging population, and our debt burden, if you kind of average it out per head, is increasing at alarming rates. So it's unlikely that in the next 10 years, you know, we'll be able to per person like afford the debt load of the country. And we're not earning enough, and inflation's killing our ability to earn. So we're in this kind of like weird crisis moment in the next little while where we do need a lot of change to happen.
We're in our moment. We're either going to take it
and
we're going to run with it, or we're going to die by it.
Right.
You know, that sounds pretty dramatic, but we have to make some decisions that are long term. We have to make some decisions that actually deal with fact, not fiction, not headlines.
Right.
Not how do you get elected. It has to be more than that.
Yeah, and I'll say that as an entrepreneur, that this is something that I see interestingly about entrepreneurship, you know, and I hope that we have a new generation of entrepreneurs across the country that kind of like take on the solutions as their take on creating solutions as kind of like their flag, because innovation comes from, I think, creating solutions where you are looking for ways to improve people's lives, enrich relationships, mm-hmm. create value.
Yeah. Gaps in necessity, right?
Yeah.
Where's the gap? What's necessary?
Totally.
Somewhere in there, great things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to create that sort of atmosphere.
Yeah, and it's got to be like abstracted from our general apathy. You know, I think that's something that takes design.
Yeah, you know, for Thursday and Friday, I was interviewing these young people. We're building a youth council.
Mm-hmm.
I had the opportunity to interview more than 20 young people. And we only have spots for 13. It's going to be a really tough decision because they were excited. They were positive. They're real. Like, they've had some serious barriers in their life.
Right.
But they're not lying down and taking it. They're like, hey, I want to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, yeah. I'm surrounded by young people who are really hopeful. But that hopeful will only ride for so long, right?
Yeah.
So I think I'm blessed. I think I'm, you know, I've got a very young team. You know, today somebody said they learned a lot in their one job, and that's what we need to do,
mm-hmm.
right? She's going to go off, and now she's decided to go into tech. She works on programming right now. Like, that's a leap. Fantastic. Yeah. We need people to take a leap like that.
Yeah, I love it. Even our team, as we bring people onto the Startwell team, no matter what their tenure is, it's something I always hear, is that I look for people who like challenges,
mm-hmm.
and then within the first week of their time working at Startwell, they love that they've already done 20 million things that it would have taken them 10 years to have those experiences.
Yeah.
And it's things like, you know, I think it was really funny because not even a year ago, you know, we had two members of our team join us on our media team. And within their first week, they met, you know, and shook the hand of the prime minister in one of our venues. And they were like, wow, you know, I just came from Brazil. I never thought it's so, I think the idea
that's awesome.
Creating these like, you know, opportunities through work to break people's expectations
mm-hmm.
of what an experience of work is, creates opportunity for everybody.
And I'll say this one last thing, you know, more and more young people are considering being an entrepreneur because they want to be their own boss. And there are some people who want to go into the charitable sector.
Mm-hmm.
I don't call it not-for-profit because I'm not a man. I'm not tall, I'm not white, so I don't call what I do a not something. Anyway, it's a charitable sector, it's a social profit sector.
Yeah.
But very few people are considering government. Yet in government, you get to make great decisions, hard decisions.
Right.
Decisions that actually will affect people. It is a place of innovation, but we don't picture it that way.
Why is that
people,
though?
I have no idea. Like, there is innovation in private sector for sure, but we only ever think about innovation
mm-hmm.
when we think about private sector. There's innovation in being a social profit. Mm-hmm. Like, if you think about what we've done, it's innovative, right? And there's innovation in government. And so part of this whole innovation ecosystem is you got to have it everywhere. You can't just have it one place.
Yeah, it has to be the Canadian mindset, you know?
Then, yeah, and I thought we were getting there. I do think that, you know, we have a lot of people who want to invest in ideas, but we have to take it further. And we really do have to encourage that kind of, in a meaningful, substantial way
mm-hmm.
amongst young people. Not everyone can be an entrepreneur.
Right.
But you can be an entrepreneur somewhere else, in government, in a social profit. It doesn't need to be for yourself.
Yeah, you can be an intrapreneur.
Right? Yeah, that's right. That's the latest term, right? Intrapreneur.
I feel like it's definitely something people ask me a lot, right? Because I find myself, you know, now in my middle age as such, surrounded by professionals all the time,
yeah.
you know? And a lot of them are doctors and lawyers and accountants and whatnot.
You have to get new friends.
What's yeah, going on I know. There? Jeez, man. It's because my wife's a doctor, you know?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. but as I talk to more professionals that are on these career tracks that started when they're 3 years old, I find that there is this assumption that entrepreneurship amongst people of those ilk, you know, are that entrepreneurship is a path that someone chooses. Fundamentally, I don't agree with that. And at the same time, I don't think it's an exclusive experience. I don't think it's, you're an entrepreneur or you're not. I definitely don't think
you can
so.
Flirt with entrepreneurism.
Yeah.
It'll go somewhere or maybe it won't, but it's going to change the way you think. And
totally.
That's key.
And I think that it's this kind of like, yeah, mindset of opportunity versus scarcity, right?
Right.
So if you have a poverty mindset, which often cases professionals do, and they're either counting their hours that are billable,
yeah,
or they're, you know, the number of patients they saw in the day or that they saved from, you know, their mm-hmm. deathbed. Everything becomes quantifiable in terms of success metrics. But if you're an entrepreneur, I mean, and this is also something I have gripes with a lot of like people in the whole pump and dump Silicon Alley emulation yeah, mode. Because entrepreneurship, even in tech, was until 15 years ago, 10 years ago in Canada, wasn't this like get rich quick scheme thing. It wasn't like, let's get to a Series D, put it on the stock market or find an M&A, you know, person and private equity will buy us our millions back. It was about kind of way of life. It was about mm-hmm. buying freedom. It was about creating opportunity, and that's about it.
Yeah, know? People forget that Canada's actually been very innovative. You know, BlackBerry was started here. BlackBerry was the first time you could go and take your... I remember I was in politics, and I was like, oh my God, I don't have to go back to the office. I can do it right here. It changed people's lives, but it came from here. Yeah. And we don't often remember that. Like, we crap all over the Canadian innovative ecosystem, but it does exist here. We just need to kick it into gear a little bit more. You know, people say this probably drives my team crazy. I start from go before I get to know. That right. is how I'm built. It might be a no, but you got to give it your best shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think that's the thing is that, like, that's the apathy that I fight against is I want to see people increasingly look for solutions that they can afford themselves rather than saying
yeah, that's well put.
The cards are stacked against me and there's too many problems. There's too many problems. It's too expensive. It's too difficult. I can't hire the yeah. people I need. I can't rent the building I need, you know? Well, maybe you can just flirt with some eviction notices that you have to kind of like put on the bottom of the pile, you know? Whatever your situation is, yeah. you know, try and make it work.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is there's lots of opportunity. It's how we position ourselves, either to take it or not. And what kind of world are we living in that encourages that kind of thinking?
So I would say in your position with King's Trust, you know, it's a position of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, from a position of leadership, what do you think the culture of leadership in Canada looks like?
You know, that's a great question. I think, first of all, leaders in this country, I do think, are big thinkers. By virtue of the fact that we are a small population in a big country.
Mm-hmm.
But leadership has become difficult and it's become tough. So everything you do is watched. Everything is measured.
Right.
There is no room for mistakes, and we're not perfect. And I think there has become this fear of being a leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're worried about you're going to say X, Y, or Z, and it's going to be heard a certain way. You know, when I have been in leadership positions in the past,
yeah.
it hasn't been this tough in some ways. Or maybe it was tougher, but it hasn't been this watched, I guess. I feel really good about my leadership because I think I reflect the team that I have, but I've got great values. That's how I was raised.
Right.
There are things that are non-negotiables for me. Respect is at the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't ask anyone to do anything that I wouldn't do myself.
Right.
That's what guides me.
Right.
But I think today, you know, I think people are afraid of being leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's terrible.
Yep.
I think there's this group of people who want to be leaders but don't understand the responsibility that comes with being a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a group of people who are terrific leaders, but there's this cancel culture where you can't make a mistake. And yeah. guess what? Everybody makes a mistake. I'm not perfect. I tell my team that all the time.
Oh, yeah, man.
And
I don't even tell them that. They just know it.
Well, mine probably do too. It's probably more for me that I say it than them.
I was asking about my work constantly. I'm asking myself, I'm like, is this great or is this shit?
But I ask myself that too. Like yeah. I, you know, but that's, I think that's normal.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Leaders need to have the space to do that.
Totally.
And when they don't have the space to do that, then everything becomes really tightly wound.
Yeah.
And then you start making bad decisions. So I think that, you know, leadership for me has changed a lot. I was mm-hmm. a leader in politics in my own way. And then I've gone on and run out different foundations. But today, I think the expectations coming out of COVID mm-hmm. have made leadership very different.
Right.
The sense of individuality has risen to the top. And I'm really used to working as a team. Now,
yeah.
we've created a culture in our office. We just got an employee survey back, which is really team driven.
Nice.
But it takes effort. So the other part about leadership is that you actually have to put in the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You have to think about what kind of culture you're creating. What opportunities are you creating?
Right.
How are you promoting? What are the titles? Who right. do you take where?
Yeah.
Right? And And sometimes, you know, it's difficult to be fair, even though you've thought you've been fair.
And I think it's also difficult because for so long, at least I'll say this in like the corporate kind of realm, mm-hmm. right? In work and enterprise, there have been so many dogmatic practices that, you know, people have inherited mm-hmm. To do with organizational behavior. So you said like roles and titles, right? All this stuff to do with power dynamics and stacking people in verticality that's, you know, doesn't make sense. From a managerial standpoint, like mm-hmm. I manage people as opposed to, you know, I'm supporting them. It's the flip.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I've seen and I've interviewed a lot of young people that come into roles and they want to be managers or directors of something. And they're looking for that title because they're looking to leverage it into the next position. Mm-hmm. Or one they might be already applying for while they're working their job here. And I will say this, that I'd rather give you a title mm-hmm. that is the purpose of your work, you know? Yeah. So like your client services, you're not manager of client services, you're just client services.
But it's not doable. Like people do want to have titles. You know, I don't believe in a flat organization. Somebody has to make decisions.
Right, yeah.
Somebody has to manage. Somebody has to report. So I think that we have, you know, really great people who want to be in leadership positions.
Yeah.
We need to give them a shot. But you can't join an organization and 4 weeks later want a promotion.
Sure.
That's just not going to work. And so I think there is some of that inflated thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have to recalibrate, right? Everyone has to recalibrate. I would say this is the decade of recalibration in everything we ever thought.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, because systems can be built from the ground up very quickly and easily these days.
Mm-hmm.
And assumptions about economic relevance as well are being challenged by the platforms that underlie them, you know, the value mm-hmm. chains, the inputs. So it's very interesting times.
Yeah.
I think if I was, you know, in my 20s, I'd be so excited right now. Like, so excited. I peel back. I was talking to someone about this just, I think, last week or maybe on the weekend. That, like, yeah, when I was, okay, like, let's take that example. The example of the BlackBerry. So pre-BlackBerry, you run back to the office or home or you don't run back. But like, I need to send someone. You run back. I need to send someone a message, or I need to get online. I need to use the computer. But it's a very defined experience in your day or in your week.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember literally taking, when was that? 96. Taking a computer with all its peripherals, heavy thing, into the car to drive to my dad's office.
We're really dating ourselves.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
To use
we're
the
cool.
telephone.
No matter what you think, we're actually cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't need a. Psh. Y'all know. But yeah, I would plug in the computer to download all my emails, to take them home, to write responses and read them, to then take it back again, you know.
Yep.
And
I'm telling you, my life changed when the BlackBerry, I was one of those people who got the BlackBerry early because I was on Parliament Hill. Mm-hmm. And I used to work, you'd crazy hours, 14-hour days. You'd go in at 6, you would leave, you know, get home maybe at 9.
Peel yourself off your
desk. And I remember, it would be 5 o'clock and I'd run back to my office at 6 o'clock and I have to do my emails. And all of a sudden, I get this little device and it changes my life.
Yeah.
I'm responding to media right there and then. They're like, whoa, right?
Right.
So I do think that, you know, the BlackBerry is a really good example, but there have been significant changes to the way we work.
Yeah.
And that has affected almost everything across the board.
But also in that, the anticipatory kind of mindset of this this sounds weird, right? Because like all technology is part of some sort of curve of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But the immediacy of communication technology today has created this kind of, I feel like there's an ethos in the workplace that's typically to do with rather than being proactive, you got a very reactive culture that's like the majorative culture. So as long as people are responding to things, then they're seen as active. And I've talked to a lot of people on our gathering podcast, which is for people in culture, executives and leaders and stuff, about even success metrics that have come out in tools for measuring engagement amongst, you know, human resources.
Well, what does engagement mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, yeah. So that question doesn't get asked when you're looking at performance metrics based off of like, you know, putting one paper into the next pile and acting in a Monty Python fashion. So it's all very interesting because I think culture was the word that you used about where we're like companies kind of need to define a culture mm-hmm. in order to, you know, develop teams that have cohesion, common good, sense of common good, and that ability to, like, I think, steer a company through whatever macro trends are happening outside of its office, right?
Yeah. I'll come back to the question you asked about leadership, though. Mm-hmm. It used to be that culture was set from the top.
Yeah.
I think more and more, and this is good, not bad, culture is created, not set, it's created from the organization. So it doesn't matter what role you play anymore. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're part of that culture. So in other words, culture is not the job of the CEO and the CEO alone. Everybody owns the culture.
Yeah, I agree.
You want to show up temperamental, you're affecting the culture.
Right.
You want to not do your job, you're affecting the culture. You want to be a superstar, you're affecting the culture.
Right.
Like, it has, this is where I think the positive stuff has come.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not my job to set culture. It's my job to be part of that culture. Now, there are certain things that a CEO does set, but it is so different now. And it's not, if a boss says to you, well, it's my way or the highway, you probably should get out. Right? Like, I know that exists. I'm not naive.
Yeah.
But more and more, that is changing. Why? Because people who are going into these jobs are not standing up for that stuff anymore. That was coming out of COVID, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's something. And then also what I've been noticing, at least here, is this is not something that's an isolatory kind of phenomenon. Like, people are used to, old schoolers are used to thinking of the within the culture of the company is different than the market reality that they interact or transact through. What's happening, at least for B2B, mm-hmm. is everyone's dealing with the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Every organization, every individual. So even customers are not necessarily either picking up on cues or nomenclature that's supposed to be specifically on brand, or, you know, like, companies are having a real, they have to embrace almost like fuzziness with their brand today, if they're not like CPG and like we're Frito-Lay.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, our colors and you know the way the logo curves. But yeah, I think you can accept as a leader a certain level of kind of individualization of the expressionism of your company.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And but it does open up a lot of quandaries for people that, you know, want to control.
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me this question 15 years ago, I would have had a completely different answer.
Yeah.
Right? I'm now in my 50s. I feel confident about my leadership. I'm not perfect. I know that. 15 years ago, I wouldn't even admit it to that. Nobody shows their weakness. Now, I know it's weird, but it's cool to show your weakness.
Right.
That's not leadership 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
No, you're right.
But it is now.
Yeah. Yeah.
That comes from somewhere, right? And I think I actually think that's a good thing.
It's a great thing.
It's not a weakness. I think it's a learning curve. And, you know, I've made some mistakes along the way, and I hopefully have learnt from them.
Right.
But I'm going to continue to make mistakes.
Yeah, but this is also part of this kind of like increasing diversification of our population. And, you know, it's funny because I think there's a lot of this. This is a big topic. I don't know if we need to go there. But the inherited biases of being, you know, in a nation born of, like, you know, Mayflower Protestantism, mm-hmm. right? And they're like, it's a very loaded topic to say. It's not just about even growing up in Canada, but saying whatever your peoples are, what's the 20 generation arc of culture that you have been formed through? And to understand that and like peel it back, I know every ancestor's story, to be able to like even reassess what your decision-making paradigm is individually, to then bring that to a collaboration and say, how do we work together as us, not as our forefathers, let alone, you know, the people we interact with every day.
That's a whole other podcast.
It's a whole other podcast.
It's a whole other conversation.
If anything, I think once again, looking to youth, I think it's quite exciting to say, the depth of information available to people at their fingertips now today, whether it's to look back or look forward or look sideways.
Yeah.
That's what's so thrilling. If I was in my 20s, I would dig into everything.
I know,
and
right?
I would just be geeking out on everything all day long.
Yeah.
and so excited about the availability of that information. Yeah. I don't need to run home to check my emails. Yes, they're in my hand, but it's not just the emails.
Yep.
Everything is, and it's interconnected. It's a very exciting time.
It is.
Okay, I want to frame this a little bit. I know we're going back and forth, but what brought you to the King's Trust? Let's start there.
So I have a few obsessions, and one of them is youth pathways, youth unemployment. I've been obsessed with this for more than a decade. So when the phone rings and somebody says, "Hey, Farah, you have an opportunity to work on your obsession," you say yes.
Of course.
So my entire career since politics has been working in service to young people. This was very focused.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it as an amazing opportunity to work within a global organization, but be able to do something specifically for Canada.
Okay.
So when the phone first rang, I'm like, what? The King's Trust? Okay, I got to learn more about it. And I didn't know very much about it. And then I met the board, I met the board chair one-on-one. I talked to some of the people who had worked there. I had a good conversation with people who had sort of worked with them in partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, there's some room here to actually create something really awesome in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard to be a charitable organization in this country.
Right.
And there's a tendency to either do something that is completely brand new or something that's duplicative or something that's just sort of run-of-the-mill stuff.
Sure.
And I'm just not built like that.
Right.
So when you do give me a challenge and say, okay, we really want to do something ambitious here and everything's on the table,
mm-hmm.
somebody like me is going to step up.
That's exciting, yeah.
I didn't know very much about the King's Trust, but as soon as I realized that it had a long history,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to be celebrating Canada. We're going to be celebrating our 15th year in 2026.
Mm-hmm.
So 15 years of doing really cool things. And the organization used to do wool, and then it spun off. It used to do Indigenous language. It spun off veterans. So for me, it was, okay, let's focus now. Let's focus and really double down on youth unemployment. Great opportunity.
So what's the work that you did leading up to this around youth unemployment? And where did that become a thing for you? A topic of concern?
So I think it became a thing for me because of my path in some ways. It wasn't easy always to get a job, and you have to ask yourself why.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Burlington, Ontario. At the time, it was not a diverse community.
Sure.
And there were opportunities that would go to other people and not necessarily to me. And I never really pinned it as I'm a woman or I'm racialized or I'm 5'1" and a quarter, because I think that height is a thing.
I didn't even realize
height's
that.
A thing. I know, you can't
talk realize you were
down.
Shorter than me.
But no, I think part of it was I struggled with opportunities.
Yeah.
But there was a moment where I didn't struggle anymore. And that was, I was volunteering on a political campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The person I was volunteering for won. I said, hey, can I get a job? She said, go back and do your master's and then come and talk to me. And then I moved to Ottawa because I was supposed to do my master's.
When were you in Ottawa?
I moved to Ottawa in 95 and I was there for 10 years.
Okay. Because I used to go to the market sometimes to DJ. I'd be invited to DJ at these places. I don't remember the names. There was one.
That I was probably shaking it down at one of those places.
These brown dudes opened a place. What was it? It was called MTL.
Oh, I remember MTL.
Remember
it was right
place?
In the market, yeah.
I DJed there. Then across the road, there was a place that was like an old school house place. I don't know if it's still there. Where like they had drums in the corner and people would like play the drums while like people were DJing.
Hmm.
Yeah, because my
cousin... Definitely missed out there.
My cousin was an MP, and so he always used to like invite me down from Montreal
okay.
to perform. Yeah, Raheem Jaffer.
Yeah, okay. I know Raheem.
You know Raheem?
Yeah, I know Raheem. I didn't realize you guys were related. See, everyone's related somehow.
Small country, man.
But for me, the game changer was this person opened a door for me in politics. And I walked through that door.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next 10 years, I had opportunity after opportunity after opportunity.
Right.
I eventually left as the director of communications to the deputy prime minister. Who would have thought a refugee in this country would be working on Parliament Hill and got to that point?
Right. Yeah.
And it's because somebody opened the door.
Yeah.
So for me, it was really important to open doors for others. That's how I was raised. That was the experience I had.
Right.
And so I think that's what started off my little obsession.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because there's two flips, right? Some people definitely in politics will, or outside of politics will kind of say, oh, it's a pretty nepotistic kind of world. And so if you don't know anyone, oh, then you'll never get an opportunity. But at the same time, that's not I don't think that's at odds with anything in the private sector.
No, I think this happens in every sector.
Right. And talking about even this bias towards youth, like we've talked to many people that are internal and external talent acquisition people mm-hmm. on the Gathering podcast. And what you find is still the case that's always been the case, which is the majority of people that get jobs of any kind, you know, in Canada, anywhere in the world, is because of personal relationships. The majority of resumes that come in, if they're stacked against a personal relationship
yeah.
or a referral, they're going to sit there, you know?
Yeah, it's not always the factor, but it's always going to help, right? And this is why, coming back to the King's Trust, we think building this program called the network mm-hmm. will serve young people well. You know, in the absence of that network, yeah, somebody else might get the jump on you.
Right.
I'm going to come back to something that you said. It does exist everywhere, yet we continue to villainize
yeah.
the political system because it's the easiest one to kick around, I think.
Yeah.
And in fact, when we do that, people don't want to join it.
Yeah, because politics, I think there's two perspectives of politics that are like subconsciously assumed, right? Especially in Canada. And we've been subject to some weird bipartisan stuff in the last couple of decades that's like odd for me as a Canadian. Because we're supposed to be like, you know, pretty socially minded, like peace and love and happiness and let's all get together. That's what we should be in my mind. Highly educated, smart, hand-holding people.
Peacekeeping nation,
right.
as we used to be known as.
Yeah, right? We used to throw... I think more money and bodies at the UN peacekeeping forces than any country in the world, if I'm not mistaken, in the 90s, like Bosnia situation.
Yeah, I mean, we really, really did show up in a bigger way than most countries, I would say. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think our kind of like, our brand has gone through all sorts of different challenges in the last couple of decades. And the champions of the brand aren't necessarily politicians, and they're not necessarily cultural icons that represent Canadian values. And, you know, I had a couple episodes ago, I had someone on who was talking about the challenges of the Canadian brand that the Olympic Committee brought to them at The Hive, which is an agency, to try and do some research on. And they were saying, they're really worried about this Paris Olympics. And they were saying, leading up to the Paris Olympics, Canadians for the last few, Olympics have not been tuning in. Whether it's winter, which should be close to heart, or summer, right? It's like, it's hockey, guys.
Yeah, you're right.
People aren't tuning in. And there's an apathy that has evolved amongst young Canadians towards calling themselves Canadian.
Oh, that breaks my heart.
And they did deep research into this. They proved that it's true. You know, and they said about kind of like making recommendations to change things. So I have to do the follow-up episode on that.
Well, let me know when that plays. That really breaks my heart. You know, I'm so fiercely proud to be Canadian.
Yeah,
I really am. And I've said this before. I feel that I live in debt to this country because of the opportunities and the fact that we came here as refugees and our lives were saved. But ultimately, what really bothers me is if we don't know what we stand for as a country,
mm-hmm.
what our brand is, what our value is.
Mm-hmm.
That is such a huge problem.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin with that. And I don't know if that's a generational thing. I remember when I used to backpack, everyone wanted to put a Canadian flag on their
You're like,
back,
don't put an
right?
American flag.
People would say, hey, can I get your Canadian flag? But, you know, it does break my heart. And I think it's there. I just think that things have evolved into a place where it's not that we don't know that we're a kind, smart, sympathetic, respected country.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I think we need to practice that in a way that gets noticed again.
Agreed. And I think we've also had this, you know, because this is still related to that political debate, or not debate, but issue of also people's kind of like abstraction from the political layer in everyday society, you know, where politics becomes a source of entertainment almost. In the last little while.
Which, shame on us.
Right.
I mean, really, I don't...
And it shouldn't
be
that.
If you want to make fun of politicians, why don't you put your name on a ballot?
Yeah.
You know, like, just...
But the sad thing is, when they become... when politicians become celebrities, and in the new media landscape where celebritization is affordable to all income levels of people, right? A celebrity is someone that, you know, could be a celebrity today and gone tomorrow... Literally as fast as TikTok algorithm buries them.
Yeah.
Or floats them up.
But there's something so wrong with that.
Totally agreed.
I guess the question is, how do you get past that? Like, you put people in places of power and decision making, but we want to treat them like shit. We want them to fly the back of the plane beside the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't understand how we got to a place where we like to villainize politicians. People want to crap on them all the time. They call them crooks. Put your name on a ballot. Try to do the job. And in every sector, there's always going to be a couple of bad apples. But when there's a bad apple in politics, the whole place is corrupt. When there's a bad apple in business, oh, that guy or
you
that
know why?
One.
This is the way I look at it. I think there's a bit of a problem here because it's very difficult to get a read for most people, especially if they're in, let's say, business or slow-moving environments, large enterprise or government, to get a by-the-minute read on the media landscape today. Mm-hmm. It's so fluid that it's dangerous to try and win popular opinion using the media today. And that, because it's everything is so temporal. So there's a communication policy question, I think, to do with what the next 5 years and 10 years will demand of the government's ability to articulate to the people. But then there's also this issue of, we as a country have done a very poor job, I think an extremely poor job, of relating what government is to the people. The people see the government as a black box. They don't understand that there's hundreds of thousands of people working in every government level to do things every day. And that in some ways, you know, the prime minister and whoever the ministerial, the kind of like front of house of the government are somewhat meaningless to the back end processes that are so deep that I think if people were more engaged with the stories of the actual work, then they would be far more sympathetic to not expecting the work of government to come from one individual or two individuals.
Yeah, I'm going to challenge that a little bit. I think the prime minister, whoever they are, whatever party it is in the cabinet, I think there's, first of all, you're right, a misunderstanding of what they do.
Yeah.
But the funny part is, great things happen, they never get credit.
Yeah.
Terrible things happen and we trample all over them.
Yeah.
So if we're going to continue that behavior, who's going to step up and be a politician? Are you going to do it? I know I don't want to run if that's how you're going to be treated.
Yeah.
So I come back to young people. What kind of world are we giving them to inherit that they actually want to be a part of?
Right.
People are, I'm sick and tired of the negativity that comes from a lot of the media. I mean, I tuned out sometimes. I used to read 6 papers a day. And I'm tuning out.
Right, right.
Right? I wake up in the morning. The first thing I do is I put CBC on. Just because I want to listen to it. I want to get the lay of the land.
Yeah.
And then I make my way to my workplace and I'm listening to Adele or whomever, right? Like I don't even listen to the news anymore.
Because the news also is not the news anymore.
No, it's mostly opinion. Let's call it what it is. It's opinion. We don't distinguish between fact and opinion anymore. We don't. The lines have been blurred.
And I mean, the bulk of media in Canada, like if we're talking about newspapers and television, it's not independent voices anymore, right? Forget about journalistic integrity. Like we've got like all the diversity of, let's call it what 20 years ago or 30 years ago might have been like regional news and local news is gone.
Yeah, that's gone.
And it's now everything's press wire.
Yeah.
So it's like Reuters, AP, and who else is there? There's like one or two sources of news.
Yeah, Canadian Press here. But, you know, what I would say is that everybody's a journalist now, right? Everyone gets on their Twitter or their whatever, and everybody's got an opinion about something.
The echo chamber,
And it's just, I find it really overwhelming.
Yeah, I you know what, to be honest, I find that even like predominantly social media outside of long form on YouTube, where I'm looking for something that's topical, or I'm engaged with watching essentially like a show as if I'm, you know, watching television. Or documentary type stuff. The rest of it is not even entertaining to me. I just personally can't find value and interest and in entertainment in like 10 second, 20 second, 60 second, 120 second clips.
Yeah.
So it is interesting because I think that's on the meta, that's a large problem, which is the medium of short form, that really is just dopamine-driven, algorithmically dopamine-driven advertising platforms. You know, being the replacement for, you know, newspapers and longer-form sources of information.
Yeah.
It's kind of a problem. But
well, it's a problem because that's how young people also consume.
Yeah.
Right? So if you think about it,
yeah.
I don't know a lot of young people who read The Economist or go and get the Globe and Mail on a Sunday or the New York Times or whatever. This is how they're consuming their information.
Yeah.
And if that's how you're consuming your information, I'm not blaming them because now we've led them down that path.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting, as you say, you're not getting long form on anything. You're getting snippets of stuff.
Yeah.
You're putting it together. And it's not based on fact often. And I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It's right? Hugely problematic. And I don't know what the solutions are. I definitely do think, though, that in the next little while, I think what would be really awesome for Canadians across the board is to have more sense of community, right?
Yeah.
And more ability to commune outside of commercial intent.
Yeah. And so where do you find that? Lots of people used to find that in religion.
Religion. Right? Yeah. So we've got this problem of like secularization, which is, you know, gotten rid of community centers effectively.
Sports. They used to do it through sports, right? But, you know, if you think about it, you're right. Community, I think, is a big thing. I think more people realized how important their community was post-COVID pandemic, than they ever realized.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we started to recalibrate, people recalibrated differently. So I think about myself. I used to go out all the time.
Right.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Four nights a week. Now it's two nights a week, and it's not my age. It's I want to.
That's twice as much as me.
You got a kid. I want to get together with people differently. I used to go out every night after work.
Yeah.
Right. And if it's me, I mean, I'm pretty social, but loads of people are now doing this. Right. They're not joining things as much. They're not going out as much. And when they do go out, they're looking at the phone and not the person they're sitting across from.
Mm-hmm.
Which again goes to how are we communicating.
Right.
You know, I go to out for dinner and I see these families and the kids are on their iPad. I'm not judging, but that is how they're learning. That is how they're communicating. And if we can't communicate one-to-one or in a group, we are so screwed. I'm with you, though. Despite this negative conversation in some ways, I'm actually an optimist.
Yeah.
Right? I do believe that the best days are always to come. You know, I think we're not in a great place right now. The world is not in a great place right now. If we want to be in a great place, we have to do the work.
Yeah.
We have to be honest about what's not working.
And I think, look, human society, it feels, there's a lot of, it kind of feels like, you know, when you look at the whole world in a few news stories, right? It feels like the world is in a bad place. But human society in some ways is most likely, you know, been through many cycles of horrible experience, and often cases that was, you know, purported by the or initiated by society itself, right? And people hurting other people.
Yeah, I will say this. So I think when I speak to young people, I think it's the number of things. So you've got climate change, which people individually don't think they can do anything about, though we can do our part. You've got the economy. You've got politics. Like, it feels for young people that everything's happening all at once. But you're right. There have been other times where everything has happened all at once. But when they're living the moment and they're living in their parents' basement.
Can I ask this?
That's tough.
What do you think about if there are kind of notes to draw from, let's call it, like the generation of people in their 20s today being the children of people in their 50s today? Right?
Mm-hmm.
On average, 40s and 50s?
Yep.
50s. 60s even. 50s and 60s.
50s and 60s, yeah.
You know, because Canada in the 70s, 80s, 90s was like, let's call it 80s, 90s, right? Was pretty like middle class.
Mm-hmm.
We're recyclers, so we're saving the environment.
Yeah.
Right? Although you remember the story that like was on the CBC before the pandemic was, you know, it was a big expose. It was that all that recycling is going to the Philippines and getting burnt.
Yeah.
That idea that we could kind of pat ourselves on the back for a long time and be like, we're doing a good job. And everything felt like kind of pretty, I don't know. I feel like we didn't reach too far, but at the same time, we didn't need to extend our hand. And I think we kind of rode that out for a while. And there was also a bear market for a good stretch there. Right?
Yeah.
Post the economic, like, actually it goes and flows because this sort of historical summarization doesn't take for granted the fluctuations in the economy. Like we left Canada in 1992 because of the recession. That was a bad recession. And like I was talking to someone who's in their 60s recently about this, and he was saying, I think in 93 he had on his house mortgage, was it 93, a 27% interest rate.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, like,
yeah, it's been worse sometimes for sure.
Yeah, so I think anyway, my point is I feel like I understand how people can you know, feel or develop a sense of apathy by looking at the difficulties human society is facing. Mm-hmm. However, that's part of human nature as well.
And
community is what strengthens the ability to relate to each other and understand the human condition, right? So I feel like that is certainly something that people need in order to have the confidence of their capabilities as a community together.
Yeah, right? Well said. I agree with that.
Yeah. So I'm optimistic about that, you know.
A party of two, optimism.
Yeah. Well, honestly, this is a big part of the work that we do here at Startwell as well, right?
It's like, oh, yeah. You guys have a culture of that, right?
Well,
that's how you built.
It's kind of interesting being a private sector space, right? Like, it's my business.
Yeah.
Hopefully, one day I'll make something out of it. But for 7 years up until this point, we've been welcoming all different types of working teams mm-hmm. to collaborate, essentially, and share knowledge.
Yeah.
Which is a funny business when you think about it as a business, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of seen largely in my sector, not necessarily in the business sector.
Right.
And so good for you for doing that, because, you know, I think we just nailed it. It's about community. It's about people, how they come together in commonality. It's not about differences. That's the easy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Finding differences, simple, easy. Finding commonalities, got to put the work in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about the next little while for the King's Trust.
Yes. Well, look, we've got these three great programs. We're at this really fantastic period. For us, success is not output, mm-hmm. it's outcome.
Right.
So when we meet a young person and they're struggling and we can put them through any one of our programs, that to me is success. One of the things that I'm really looking forward to is finding the space for us within the larger ecosystem, right?
Because of
people who work in youth.
Okay.
You know, we are part of that ecosystem. I think we need to come together.
Mm-hmm.
I think the King's Trust can be a really great convener for that.
Excellent. Yeah.
The other thing I'm super excited about is we are working our way through how are we going to work with Indigenous youth. That's exciting for us,
mm-hmm.
right? It's an opportunity. We're doing some consulting right now with Indigenous people, young people, those who work with young people, and getting some really great advice. So I'm really looking forward to activating that. We are a national organization. We could be a lot more national.
Right.
You know, being able to operate in both French and English is really important. Growing out our board. I have the best board. I'm not saying that, you know, whether they listen to it or not, I have a great board. They're very focused. But they're also really realistic, right? And for me, having the right board with the right team, with the right programs, the right funders, that's the dream.
Yeah.
So we're going to go into a massive fundraising campaign.
Okay.
I'll tell you now, I'm going to call it a human capital campaign.
I like that.
We're not putting our name on anybody, nobody's name is going on a building, but we're investing in humans.
Right.
So let's call it what it is. So exciting days ahead for the King's Trust and... you know, I just hope that people will understand, whether it's through the King's Trust or some other way, I mm-hmm. hope that people understand that now is the time for youth and we have to rally behind them.
Has the King made any comments about Canada or, you know, what's his perspective on having seen, you said 15 years in mm-hmm. 2026,
mm-hmm.
having seen that time period pass
mm-hmm.
and, you know, him becoming King, you know, but also looking to Canada and his perspective on Canada and the youth in Canada?
Yeah, it's a great question. A couple of years ago, he was here.
Okay.
And he had the opportunity to meet with some young people. And I think he walked away with an understanding that there are some amazing things here, talent, you know, wanting to help young people, and that there was a lot of work that needed to be done. So that's the first thing I would say. The other thing is most people don't know this, but just before his coronation, the king met with the leaders of First Nations, Métis, the AFN, Métis, and ITK. And he met with them to better understand what some of their challenges are. And there's a direct line now to his office with these three organizations, because it's such an important part of who we are. I've also, you know, we report to the king, all the CEOs report to the king every 2 months. We write out what we're doing. We highlight some stuff. You know, this report from Deloitte that we put out, we didn't do it because it's a nice to have. It's a lot of work. And the reason we did it was because we really do need to get straight on what the reality is. Now, we've sent a copy of this report to the king. I'm told he reads all types of things. Next time he comes, I want to show off to him what we've done.
Right.
Right? I want to show him that through these programs, through our partnerships, through our convening power, we've moved the bar. So we'll see. But I'm super excited. You know, I've had some really cool jobs in my life. I'm super excited about this role because I do think that it is absolutely important, and it's exciting. You know, it's exciting to watch and be with a young person who's like just hitting their stride.
Right.
Right. And we have to all remember we were young. We all struggled.
Yeah.
Right. In different ways.
Well, and I mean, I made that joke that like I kind of, you said, you know, youth have the ability to not be filtered, to be unfiltered.
Yeah.
And I made the joke that I'm chastised for that.
Yeah, you do it as an adult is what you said.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great thing, though, that very few people outside of the arts, right, are able to kind of be expressive. And I think that that's really important because that expressionism is what enables people to then get excited about things.
Yeah, I do think there's an art there, right? And there's a, you can really move the bar if you're being honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this role, in this organization, that's really important to us. When you talk about values, that's super important.
Nice.
So maybe I'll be a bit braver and have no filter sometimes.
There
we'll
you go.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, exactly. Open up. Well, it was a great conversation.
Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for taking time to be here. And tell us a little bit about your history and the work that you're doing, why you're excited.
Thank you very much, and congratulations to you and your team again. It's nice to be in this space again, and you've done wonderful things, so I hope you'll have more people come through here, because the vibe here
fingers
is
crossed.
Fantastic. It's I'm crossing everything. My,
seven
my
years.
Feet are crossed, my fingers are crossed, my arms are crossed.
7 years of building.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today. Of course, if you want to learn more about my guest on the show, you can look at the description of this video, and be sure to subscribe to the channel so that we can update you whenever we post a new episode.